This is part one of our interview with Bobby Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez, recorded right before we all went into quarantine. As always,
the SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content. Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I jump in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
Could be something that I want to make or have. I pump it in my SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile. Let's open up the SparkFile.
Welcome to the SparkFile, your bouncy castle for creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a SparkFile? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are good questions, and we've got answers.
A SparkFile is a place where you consistently collect all your inspirations and fascinations. And if you're like us and you're making stuff all the time, you know that sometimes the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry. We're here to refill it.
Yes, we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity. Things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or a whole host of musicals that feature fish, princesses, Pooh Bears, commuters, Mormons, and or mariachi.
Or a collaboration that balances love, professionalism, productivity, and creativity.
Or a home filled with music.
Or a musical anthem that will outlive all of us.
On today's Makersode, we're going to talk with some folks who truly spark us.
And those folks are Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez. Bobby Crispix, welcome to the SparkFile.
Hi, guys.
We're so happy to be here.
We're so happy you're
Thank
here.
You.
But wait.
The SparkFile prize of admission, real quick. Each of you have to tell us a creative risk that you have taken recently. Just something that felt like progress, but not perfection.
Something that made you shit your pants a little bit.
Just a tiny bit.
Well, I guess mine happened because we got a chance to collaborate with Lin-Manuel on something that's
nice.
Coming up. And he's Lin-Manuel.
He's Lin-Manuel.
But you've been friends for a long time.
We've been friends, but we had to collaborate in front of each other.
That's hey. New and different.
All three of us.
How'd you approach that?
With bravery. With bravery and sunny afternoons and a sense of humor and also permission to fail.
Nice.
Permission to just be like, I might just really... shit my pants.
Yeah. Did you, when were you like, this requires bravery?
I didn't realize it until he showed up. And then I did, when I'm nervous with somebody, I lose my words, which is a bad thing if you're a lyricist.
tell them about
the pool. So he came, we were renting this amazing house in Connecticut to try and take a break.
Give the address,
and it had this pool that was far away from the house, and we worked and we were sort of talking about the problem, and then we were like, you know, let's go and we'll have some lunch and we'll go in the pool. As we were walking over, I said,
I know.
As we're walking over, I said, I'm just going to take a quick dump in the pool and then I'll go get the...
There's
the lunch.
Yeah.
And Bobby didn't let it go.
This is one of those things like, do we just let that lie there like a dump in the pool?
Oh, God.
It was either like, I'll go jump in the pool or a quick dip in the pool.
Yeah.
But I combined the two and told them I was going to poop in the pool and then go get him lunch.
Oh,
and
God.
That's when I realized, there's something in me that feels scared to to collaborate with someone who has inspired me and you know, done what he has done.
And what do you do in that moment? Like when you recognize that, oh shit, this is what's happening. What do you do to like calm yourself down or change your mindset? Do you have a process?
Well, one of the processes I did is after he left, because we didn't do too much in front of each other that day. After he left, I told Bobby, I was like, I felt like such an asshole and I lost
full
these
confession.
Words.
Just fully confessed. And, you know, there was a fair amount of like, when you said this in front of Lin-Manuel about when you called me out for saying dump in the pool, I felt a little bit called out.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can understand that. Yes. And I'm sorry. And yeah. I won't do that the next time you say that.
Yes.
Right, but I will giggle inside.
But this is where the creative relationship and the couple marriage yeah. relationship intersects, oh, yeah. right?
Right. We have a wonderful safety most of the time. We have a great, you know, and if we aren't safe in that moment, we have a great ability to say, you know, when this thing happened, here's what I was feeling.
Yeah.
It's gotten much better as we've learned to use the right language so that it doesn't sound accusatory.
It's right. like a way of talking to one another that we learned from a professional that is very helpful. In
when
terms
you
of,
did X, well, it's not, I felt
that,
Y.
We knew that one already, but the one that we learned is like,
oh yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
have to like look at each other.
Yeah.
And then when the person is done talking, then the other person has to basically repeat everything that person said.
Did you go to right. one
it's
a called Imago?
It's conscious dialogue yeah. out of Imago yes. therapy.
Yeah.
And then you say like, did I get that right? And
that's
then
right.
they get yes. a chance to edit basically yeah. what they intended. And so it's like all about hearing really hearing each other,
really?
Not just waiting for your turn to talk. Yeah. And being like,
okay, I have my counter argument right now.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying, but what I want to say
yeah,
is.
Yeah. She shut up. Here I go.
You know, it's so funny because I actually took that modality and I started teaching it to creatives, to collaborators, to actors, so that they could calm down and actually, because we hear that so much. If you ask Meryl Streep, like, what's the secret of great acting? Meryl Streep acts like she hasn't been asked that question 3 million times. Mm. And then she says, I think it's listening, but nobody ever really teaches you how to do it. And that is the fastest way, even though sometimes it can seem like a slow way. I think it's the fastest way to get to that real deep bionic sort of listening. And I love that you do it. And it makes sense to me because I see the health of your relationship.
Yeah. We didn't always have it. Like we definitely
today. I see the health of your relationship today.
Evolved that out of, you know, constant growth and yeah. all of that. And just circling back to pulling Lin-Manuel into all of this.
Yes.
It was interesting. I think
back to
that,
the money.
That first that first time that he came to our rental house and he was so busy and we were really nervous. And then the next time we got together, it was much more casual and much more like let's collaborate.
Get
let's
to work.
Really
let's have fun.
And let's share our experiences as writers for under a lot of pressure from various people. And,
yeah,
with mutual respect, I'm sure. Like I'm sure he has similar thoughts about the two of you.
I mean, I wouldn't know where it would come from because he's friggin' Lin-Manuel.
I mean,
but
he's Lin-Manuel.
We had it was
a love fest.
Yeah,
yeah.
It got safer and easier to the point where I was able to like, you know, just create right in front of him and record things and make up music in front of him without feeling like I'm creating in front of him.
Yeah. But it sounds like in answer to Cammie's question, it sounds like you really, as soon as you could, the next available appointment that you had, you were able to like turn to each other and say, and just process it out. Like, I didn't feel great when you repeated it and laughed and everybody laughed. Like, you know, not to re-traumatize
you. Clothes all of a sudden. Was at school.
Yeah, but it sounds like you processed it as quickly as you could. And that's what helps you get to that place where you can be like, and now we can sit in a room together and make with Lin-Manuel.
And relax.
Yeah, I think we had to tell the story to several other friends too about the time that I told Lin-Manuel I was going to poop in the pool.
I mean, taking a dump in the pool is a really funny thing. I'm sorry.
That's a really good price of admission.
Yeah.
What do you
have?
Well, we were just in Los Angeles for the Oscars, and we for the first time we went to this particular dinner, which we had always missed, and it was this year. It was going to be all of the music nominees at one dinner and all the acting nominees as well.
The same dinner.
Everyone
really?
That could make it anyway.
That's nice. Amazing.
And they made it very clear. They said, and last year, Lady Gaga there's a piano and Lady Gaga just played The Night Away. And we hope that that happens too.
Oh, God.
Wow. Just spontaneous.
Sing for your supper.
And wow. I was so excited and so terrified. Right?
And I was super terrified because, you know, I don't do a lot of that. I don't do a lot of playing piano in front of people. And I don't do a lot of...
With a brandy snifter tip jar on the
certainly
piano.
Not like... I'm not used to being compared to Lady Gaga or Elton John or any
I
of
I think
these.
Of you as a young Lady Gaga. Go ahead.
I can see it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, we're about the same age, actually.
You do play piano in front of our friends a lot and in front of our family, but you don't.
Yeah, I play it, but
I... play it all the time.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, but, you know, it's
felt like a different stage.
In the moment, or how long did you have to?
We knew it was coming.
Okay,
it was like 2 weeks, and it was really one of the reasons that we left our children a day early to get to this party because it sounded like your dream. You know,
super memorable.
Like,
it was my childhood dream. Obviously, I mean, it was like to be in a room with stars and get to play the piano and they sing and I sing.
They
and
tip you.
Kristen sings. We all just it's going to be amazing. Yeah. But then as soon as the reality sets in, I have like a week to worry about it and just feel.
How did that live in you for that week?
It was just dread. Oh. It just felt like dread.
Oh.
Like always.
You weren't
always,
like going through fake books and being like, oh, I gotta get my shit together. Really?
I tried to learn some of everybody's music just in case that came up.
God.
And as it turned out, we didn't play our own stuff at all. I ended up, all the youngins would play all the their heroes stuff.
Right.
I played Tiny Dancer.
Uh-huh. And, as Elton John was leaving, because he left a little early.
Wait, how was it actually when you were living it?
And, well, it was more drunken, so I was feeling better. Self-medication.
There were a lot of drinks.
Liquid courage.
Party.
I was going to ask, how does the dread turn, like when does that turn for you before or you in the middle of doing it you suddenly realize that hey I think I'm having fun?
I think there's a little bit of, you know, just any perform, like you guys perform, you know what how it is a little bit, and it was and you know there was a little bit of like I'm gonna die die that sort of thing. That moment you
here.
Use that energy to walk over to the piano confidently and just play. So, and they, you know, I think
they played all night.
They were grateful that someone was there that could play.
Yeah.
Oh, and
tell them you're Quincy Jones.
Yeah,
so Quincy Jones was there.
Quincy Jones walked in, and I had just read an article where Quincy Jones said Paul McCartney was a shitty bass player. And I was like, oh no.
Oh God.
Judgy bitch.
By the way, all of this was going on, and Bobby was not communicating any of that to me.
Right?
I mean,
could you tell?
The week
tell
before,
something was going on?
He had said, "Like, I'm a little nervous about playing the piano in front of like Elton John," and we knew we were going to be with our fellow nominees, and so it's Elton John. It was Randy Newman.
Jesus Christ!
But I was like, Cindy Arrivo will be there, and she'll sing "Fine, Fine Line," but she ended up. Which is a song that got her into the Royal Academy.
You're kidding.
She sang that song to get into graduate school.
Amazing. Wow.
So I was like, you can hold on to that. Let's just focus on that.
Yeah, that was my that was my life raft, but then she wasn't there.
Oh no.
But and in walks Quincy Jones and my heart skips a beat because he's a legend of music. Like,
and he's got opinions.
Popular music of
Yeah,
and he's not afraid to just say, "You suck, man." Like,
you suck so hard, man.
But Joaquin Phoenix was also messing with Bobby at the time. Phoenix was jokering around with him too.
There was this nice person from the Academy who said, "Can I get you a drink?" And I was like, "Oh, that's very nice of you. Yes, I would like a scotch on the rocks, please." And then she walked over to the bar, and Joaquin said, "Man, she's not your assistant. That's not cool." And then he was like, I'm fucking with you. And then she came back and delivered the drink and smiled and walked away. And he's like, "You weren't going to like tip her $2, man? Like, that's not cool."
Oh my God.
Like, just $2.
Jeez,
Joaquin Phoenix is pulling a whole Joker thing
mental
on him.
Tough room.
Bobby's like, "Quincy Jones, he doesn't like Paul McCartney."
So I walked over to Quincy Jones and I was like, this is a really impressive room, but as soon as you walked in, that's when I lost it, sir. Like, you're amazing. My name's Bobby Lopez. He's like, I know who you are. I know what's going on.
So super warm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Kristen walked over and she's like, I'm his wife. And Quincy Jones says, I know, he was just bragging on you. And then he winked at me.
I thought, oh, that's so nice. What was he saying?
I was like, this guy is awesome. I love Quincy Jones.
Wow. And you know, the post note to that is that Quincy Jones told somebody, like, that kid's a good piano player. So,
hey.
Yeah, he came up to me, gave me a fist bump. Bobby. He was like, you're good.
Did you sleep like an angel?
Yeah,
that night?
Was good. Yeah. Yeah. Then, as I was playing, Margot Robbie came and sat down next to me on the piano bench.
Oh my gosh.
And said, will you play me something?
Oh. And so hello. He played, she's always a woman to me. And then I saw what was going on and she was like sitting next to him. And I was like, oh, she takes care of herself. Big Ethel Merman.
You went full musical theater. Amazing. I think you're officially admitted into the Spark Fund.
Yeah,
those are some good risks. Thank you for inviting us to your office / musictorium.
Thank you.
It's just us talking now, but this aside, is there ever not music going on in your home, in your life, it seems like
in your head.
In your head.
When Kristen says, please be quiet, then I stop.
Well, he does. So I have a lot of music in my head, and I have a lot of, like, sometimes I'll get caught. And I do think there's a little bit of an OCD thing that happens on certain phrases that just happen round and around. Mm-hmm. And then when I finally get it quiet, if Bobby like gets on the piano and starts playing Billy Joel or something,
opens
then,
a can of earworms.
Yeah.
Yes.
But then I take a second and I like to remind myself, like, what if the day comes and he's not there to play the piano? So you better appreciate it.
Way to bring it down, Christmas.
Wow. Hey,
but
perspective.
Coronavirus is making me think a lot about.
I was going to ask if you are when you have an earworm and you're perseverating on that. New York is coming for us, everybody.
Mm.
Is that problems that you're trying to solve musically, or is it like a Billy Joel song that's stuck in your head?
When we're writing a song, it's definitely, I'm solving it.
Yes.
I notice when we're writing these songs, I will go home with it and dream it all night long.
Yes.
And all and throughout
working
my dream, I will be completely working on it. I'll even be writing lyrics to it and I'll wake up in the morning and it'll like, that definitely happens.
God.
And so whenever people come up to us and like, you and your earworms, I've been hearing Remember Me in my head like, for 3 months. And I'm like, I was there first.
That's right. I didn't.
No pity.
Try writing, yeah.
What strikes me about that is, you know, with all the people that we talk to, we find these sort of like recurring themes. And one of them seems to be like really prolific creative people trust their brain, meaning like, I'm not necessarily working on this right now, but I trust that my brain is. So whether I'm sleeping or meditating or doing a puzzle or whatnot, like just let my brain do it. It's going to solve it. Mm. And I really love hearing you talk about it that way because you seem to have a real like healthy relationship with your brain.
You know, I'm sorry that I didn't get this done in time, but what I really wanted to have on the wall here was a sign that says, do not bang head on wall.
Don't do it. There's things happening in there. Yeah. You might disrupt it.
That's right. If you get a problem and you're really stuck on it, the better thing to do than just keep trying and getting angry and getting upset is just to walk away and let your brain figure it out for you.
I find it's the amazing shower.
Yes.
Like the shower and the bathroom.
Tell it.
I call them epiphanies. when you're just like, I can't do this. I'm going to the bathroom. And then you're sitting on the toilet and you're like, ah.
I got it.
Yeah.
Fractals or whatever it is.
Oh, that's so good. So good. Before we get too far down this road, we do have this question for people, you know, who maybe...
For the woodworkers.
I'm talking to you woodworkers
there. For the woodworkers, here's a two-parter. Creatively speaking, when people ask, what do? How do you answer that? And part two, what are the things that you're most well-known for? And please don't be shy, because we will name them if you don't.
I usually say, you know, I'm a songwriter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Yeah, I felt compelled to say what I used to say, uh-huh, and now what I do say.
Oh, good, good.
Because first in my 20s, there was always that problem of when I was a performer, yeah, of feeling like you couldn't say, I'm an actress, especially if you were spending the bulk of your time temping. So right, that was always the hard part. Yeah. And then when I transitioned from performer to writer, that got even more confusing. Yeah. And it got like, I found myself saying like, well, you know, I work with schizophrenic patients during the day, but I am learning to write musicals at night, and that's what I want to do. Now I'm very lucky that things have worked out in a way that
things
I'm able
have really
to say.
Worked out.
I think I'm allowed to say like, I'm a songwriter.
Yeah, legit.
And but even now I still like, we do so much story. Mm-hmm. We do so much like executive producing and song producing.
That's right. Yeah.
And huge amounts of dramaturgy. Saying you're a songwriter doesn't feel like it covers
it's not a big enough container.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we just hop back?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to jump.
Sure.
You were a performer. You came to New York to be an actress, and then you made a transition. You changed a choice. Can you talk a little bit about changing that choice? It sounds like it took some time, and you had to figure out the language, and that evolved as you figured it out. But talk a little bit about changing your choice.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you the 30-second pitch of something that I've done as like a 20-minute talk. But
great.
The thing is, I started in that Follow Your Bliss way when I was like 6 years old, loved theater, loved story, and I would make up musicals in my backyard and direct them and cast them and design them and star in them.
And those were good shows.
I had a whole neighborhood of repertory company.
Yes.
Claudine and Matthew Thomas and Alexandra.
You weren't bossy, were you?
Yes. I had leadership skills.
That's right.
And the message I got out of all of that was, you're an actress. You like musical theater. Mm-hmm. You must be an actress.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody thought, oh, she's a director, or she's a writer, or a songwriter, or a composer.
Producer. Yeah.
And I think I swallowed that message in a big way. So much so that when a fortune teller looked at my hand, or no, it was like a hand reading manual with my friends, and they were like, your hand is a writer. I cried, and I was like, this book is wrong. Because
well, you
I
weren't
was an
wrong.
Actress.
I mean, those books are wrong. Sorry.
Cut to, you know, did well in high school, got into Williams College, got a BA degree in theater and psychology. But it didn't prepare me to be an actress, to audition for like nonsense.
Right.
I had to figure that out myself, and played a lot of nuns in New Hampshire for my 20s. But I was temping most of the time to be able to afford to play those nuns in New Hampshire.
Which nun?
I was the one from Brooklyn.
I think I played that nun. Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
And then I was also Maria. And then I was also I played a lot of the nuns. I did all the nuns.
The nun
you
circuit.
Could do. Robert Ann, Sister Robert
Ann. Sister Robert Ann, that's right.
Anyway, cut to things are just, I'm turning 27, which I think is a really key moment for everybody. There's some sort of number 27.
That's right.
That you go.
You and the hand reading and the numerology and all of it. Yeah.
But I noticed like that's when many of us take stock of it's the 5-year plan has not worked out for out of college. And I thought, this isn't working.
That ain't it, kid.
That ain't it, kid.
Sorry.
Tried a lot of things. Worked with schizophrenic patients. Did a lot of different things.
For real. Oh, I thought you were just talking about actors.
No.
You meant actual schizophrenic
patients. I was actually working at the Bronx VA hospital. This is going long. I'm going to try and cut to the
short
thing.
You're doing great. Yeah.
I ended up saying, well, gosh, working with schizophrenic patients is just as hard as playing nuns in New Hampshire.
Right.
And it feels just as not quite right. Went back to...
I wonder if you're the only person with that perspective.
Who does that feel just right for?
I mean, there's some people that like it.
Yeah, for sure.
Psychiatry is really their calling.
Yeah.
For me, I just was missing the creative side of things.
Did
a little cabaret where I rewrote some Sondheim lyrics, and someone who had been through the BMI workshop, I rewrote Opening Doors for Merrily We Roll Along to be our opening of this show called Opening Doors. And someone said, you're a lyricist. And I realized I had been rewriting lyrics and doing like forbidden Broadway things in all of my shows.
Yeah.
And he had been at the BMI workshop.
And wow.
Then I was in Urinetown. also, I was temping during the day, but I was in the original Urinetown.
Mark Holman
had been through the BMI workshop and also was like, you're a lyricist.
Wow.
So I applied to BMI.
Wow.
And it was, I wrote my first show, my first song and performed it. And it that was when it was truly like that magical, the skies open. I was like, this
is like, the thing.
I don't know that it was the greatest song. I could tell you it wasn't, but I could tell you that feeling, that
like
connection,
a key turned.
Mm-hmm. Feeling the audience laugh at what I did, and knowing that like this was performing and knowing the human voice and knowing story all happening. And then the crazy thing is I met this guy 2 weeks later. Like, so
damn.
I found BMI
lightning
workshop
bolt. Lightning bolt
was wow. like one stop shopping for my purpose and my soulmate. So,
if,
ladies,
if that's not the BMI. Best advertisement for BMI. My God.
Damn. I love hearing that story because we talk with so many people that I think they lock into a choice at a young age and then they just are so tormented by the idea of changing their choice. And it's like, no, like you can change your choice. Yes.
It is hard and there is grief. But I think there's also a lot of sorting through. And I tell I say this to especially female audiences and female artists all the time. Mm. We still have this message that if you're a woman in musical theater, that you're an actress.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see all of the different ways you can love and be a part of this life of stories and music and not have to go through the crazy stuff that the actresses go through.
Yeah.
And that it's okay to go back to where you fell in love, like trace your steps back to that moment that you were like, I love this. And it might've been a cast album. Or it might've been a play you did when you were in second grade that you wrote about the dwarves, Snow White's dwarves or whatever dwarves.
Or any dwarves.
That might lead you to where you actually want to
I love
be.
That.
That's right.
I love that. It's okay to change your choice, everybody.
It is.
And part two, what are the things that you're most well known for?
Yeah.
Bobby, I think you should take that. I've been talking a lot.
Take it, Bobby.
I did want to say one thing that came to mind was when you were talking about changing your choice, which was that also applies on the micro level all the time.
Yes.
When you're collaborating, when you're, you know, because for me, I so often had that, like, I had this idea for this song or this whatever, this moment, and I have to stay to this true north and it's stopping me. Something's not quite right, but I don't care. I'm just going to make it work. And the answer so often is, relax about that and try something else or listen to your collaborator or just become an audience member and just forget that True North for a moment and say, like, where would I put True North now if I had to change?
If I was in the audience, what would I want to see?
Yeah, right. If I wanted this to be good, what would I do?
Yeah, sometimes you do have to do that and just put yourself in the audience.
And I just feel like I'm starting to learn that lesson, like, now I've been so often like been the let's stay on target, everybody.
You can be like a dog with a bone, and sometimes I love that, and sometimes I'm like down dog.
Yes, release it.
I just one more thing that I think about, you're allowed to change your choice. I think so much of it also has to do with feeling like you're letting down teachers and parents and the narrative.
And
the
maybe
narrative
you incurred school debt for that choice, things like that.
Right,
maybe you made a declaration at some point, this is what I'm going to do.
Oh,
and then it's a little like embarrassing or you carry with it, you know, perceived shame
but yeah. I would also say it, like, if you did were the leads in your high school musical, mm-hmm. so much codifying comes with that, that everyone's like, you're going to Broadway. But external, no one says like, you're going to Broadway as the writer.
That's right.
Yeah, so surprise, often when you say this so to young people, they're like, nah, you mean I'm not good enough to be an actress. Yeah,
nobody wants to hear it because, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with what's sexy to yeah, the partners that you are seeking at age 16.
That's right.
Because, and I've talked about this before too, Bobby at age 16, if he sat down and started to play Billy Joel, a bunch of girls would come over and be like, oh my God, Margot I love Robbie. Piano Man.
Margot fucking Robbie. Margot yeah. Robbie, play yeah.
It still happens. If a girl sits down and starts playing the piano, it's not like the football players come over and they're like, I love the interval girls. Whoa, that's so cool. Right? Like, there is
won't you play
there
something?
That's right.
Some real gender things around this. And you're lucky if you get, you know, the clarinetist saying like, oh, I really love that.
Yeah.
I think it is changing. I see my daughter just wrote a song and put it on TikTok on her ukulele. And I was so proud of her, and she got all this like and love
instant.
I mean, that has its own problems, of course, right. But I think that TikTok universe is making it safer for girls to find their maker voice, mm-hmm. and not just have to be Marianne.
That's right.
In the High School Musical of Music Man.
That's right. And better to be getting likes for having written a song or done something creative than all the other ways that kids are getting likes online, you know. That's pretty impressive.
But I think that is creating some of the gender inequality around songwriting happens really early in that adolescent space because of will it attract a partner or not?
Yes, yes. Isn't that the overriding question we get taught as women from day one? Will this or will this not lead to a ring on my finger? You know, uh-huh. And it's so there's so much of that that's just sewn into the way people talk to young ladies.
I also think maybe I could yes to all of this, but also I was thinking, I don't know, as a young person, like as a like say you in your backyard, like making the show run, if you could necessarily conceptualize what a songwriter does in the way that you know what an actor does. There's so many, you know, picture books and examples of what a actor does, but it's a little more sophisticated.
Well, that's why I try to be really vocal about it, because mm-hmm. to me, what a songwriter did was like, in those cast albums, they were records then. It was just like angry men around a piano smoking, like pictures of men who looked really upset.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what a songwriter was.
Yeah. Black and white guys.
Yeah.
In black and white pictures. Yeah. And now I try to be out there as much as I can, as like, this is fun. Look, I'm wearing a shiny green dress and I'm sitting behind Parasite.
Yes.
My God. Yes. Which is what I was just at the Oscars in a very shiny green dress.
Yes. Being all fancy.
Yeah. Being
for
fancy.
Songwriting.
We just did a spark about Hedy Lamarr and mm-hmm. the filmmaker who did this great documentary called Bombshell about Hedy Lamarr, who in addition to being a beautiful, physically beautiful movie star, was also an amazing scientist. The reason why she wanted to make the movie is because she was like, when you say scientist, you picture usually a white guy with a pocket protector, mm-hmm. da, 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 da. And she was like, that can't be it, kid. And it's what you're saying too. Yeah. You want to create a new model. This is what a songwriter looks like.
Right. And I do think there's a lot of momentum behind this with Georgia Stitt founding Maestra, this new organization, and Janine Tesori and Lisa Krohn and there's Amanda Green, like there Lynn Ahrens. Like there's a lot more models of how you can be a songwriter and not being an angry white guy smoking a cigarette from the 1960s. Some of those guys are my heroes.
It can look so many
those guys
more
are
ways.
Great. Yeah. And it can look more ways.
Yeah.
So what have you written?
Yeah, we got to get back to this question.
What have you written?
And then I want to add to that. And then I want to hear your origin story as well, your creative journey.
Well, Avenue Q is my first big show.
Yeah.
Heard of that.
Broadway. Uh-huh. And then Finding Nemo, the musical. A lot of people, that's their favorite show of ours.
Yeah.
In Walt Disney World.
Yeah. It runs like 5 to 6 times a day, 365 days a year.
Beautiful little fishies. Nemo.
And then Book of Mormon.
Book of Mormon. Winnie the Pooh. Nobody knows that one.
Winnie the Pooh came out the same day as the final Harry Potter. I think it was like July 11th, 2011.
Wow.
So that was like 3 people saw it, but it was a sweet one.
Yeah.
And then
Frozen.
Well, you're right. And I had In Transit, which was like an acapella.
Yes.
Right.
Broadway
musical. I was into that one. Yep.
That was a hard one. And then we had Up Here after Frozen in the movie. We had Up Here in La Jolla. Closed out of town. And then we were really busy doing Frozen Broadway while also writing Frozen 2.
Yes.
Pretty much brings. Oh, and Coco.
And Coco.
Beautiful. Which was a bigger project for us. We ended up with just one song in a bunch of different reprises.
Great song.
Yep.
Great fucking song.
We're going to just do one.
Do that song.
Good one. Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. It was a beautiful movie. And we worked a lot on the story for Coco. Like we were involved in the
beautiful story.
I mean, it's an incredible.
I just love that movie. I was just going to say,
I didn't want to interrupt that.
Do you have any other syllables for
ooh.
Us?
Ooh. I do.
The wonderful thing about working for Pixar and Disney is that you, as a songwriter, you get to sit in and be part of the brain trust on, which is an incredible experience.
Is that unique?
That storytelling, I feel like that storytelling from those studios is extraordinary, and it's the thing that elevates those movies to be sort of just like several cuts above.
Yeah,
the storytelling, the way that those stories are honed.
But is that part of why? Maybe because it seems they're inclusive of the whole creative team.
Well, it's a brutal process, but in that brutality,
we find pleasure.
Pleasure and pain, I mean, always.
You're getting the forces of the, like your most critical audience at early stages.
Yes.
And over again in an iterative way.
Ooh.
So, I mean, just watching it from as songwriters and being part of it for the last decade now, it was like grad school, better than anything we could have experienced in grad school.
It seems intense.
About story and arc and character and process.
Yeah.
And trusting the process.
Those have to be intimidating rooms as well.
Well, it's just so devastating. Every time you put this movie together, it's been a huge push.
Yeah.
There's always some crazy, there's like a 3-week window for writing to occur, after which they have to start boarding
executing
everything.
Executing
the storyboards.
Of course.
You know, there's a little wiggle room here and there, but basically you get these 3 weeks and then they have to board it all. And then after 3 months has passed, you put it up again and it's another devastating, terrible day.
The metaphor I like to use is you build a giant Lego city in like an acre long gymnasium. And then every 3 months, someone comes and smashes your Lego city. And then you take whatever buildings are left standing and then you start building a new Lego city. And you do this 7 to 8 times. And hopefully by the end, you've got a beautiful Lego city or
that's years. So that's literally years for one of these.
That's that process. That's sort of the screening process, which is that iterative every 3 to 4 months is about 3.5 years. But before that, you've got 2 to 3 years of development where you're researching and you're like, we started Frozen 2 in 2015.
Wow.
And that was on a fast track. Like a lot of these movies that come out.
But I think it's why I must be painful. And it must be a lot of things to have the Lego city sort of broken down and have to rebuild it and have it broken down and have to be and have it rebuilt. But those stories are structured so beautifully. Like that's what you get. That's what you get.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things is like the as much as cool as these storyboard artists are and as talented as they are in envisioning a movie and executing it in this kind of rough way, it's not acting. Like you can't see the acting on the screen. Yeah. So I guess the idea is if you still feel the story in this terrible, you know, inadequate medium, then once it's animated, it'll only work better. And that those animators, you start to, I mean, this time around was kind of like, this is our last one probably. And we really, really saw the immense magic created by the animators.
It wow.
continues to just baffle us how amazing these people are.
It, I mean, it's
true.
Now we have, I think the first time around with Frozen, we were so busy being worried about our own stuff and like deer in the headlights that we didn't fully acknowledge how every step of the way the animators and what each level of artist at Disney adds each time.
Like, unbelievable.
You get the storyboards and mm-hmm. then you get the backgrounds and then you get the animators animating like every little eyebrow twitch and facial expression, and then you get the dress and you get the hair and then you get the lighting
and the voice artists like the
right
them too, the whole thing. The what's really cool about guys. Disney is like it's a building when it's going right. It's a building full of passionate artists who are all fired up, excited, and working together. Like it's amazing. It's really amazing,
right? And I mean I only just at this Oscar party got a chance to talk to the casting director who put together Josh and Kristen and Adina and Jonathan. Wow.
Who is that person?
Her name is Jamie.
Well done, Jamie.
Jamie Sparer Roberts.
Yes.
Ooh, woo!
Yes.
Nice.
Brain
at work there.
And I, you know, it was the first time that I got to really go, hey, human being who made my life better.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Thank you for bringing these four incredible people, because I do think that Josh and Kristen and Adina and Jonathan and the way that they work as the toolbox of incredible talent that we get to use there, and they're so different and they're so much like their characters, or their characters have grown to be so much like them.
How early in the process do you know, like for the first time around, when were they cast so that you like can knew start the writing. Voices you were working with?
We
didn't know
we
at
had
first.
An early, well, Kristen and Adina were there for the first table read we ever saw.
Right.
And they sang, they wheeled in this piano, like a keyboard, and Bobby and I were like, what's happening? We didn't write a song for it. And they sang You Are the Wind Beneath My Wings in harmony after the table read.
Just to hear their voices?
I guess it was sort of as a way to pitch it.
Yeah, got it.
But no one had told us
that was happening. We were suddenly
surprise
like,
and delight.
What is happening? Anyway, that continues to be
here's a little preview of the songs you're going to write for us.
Awesome. Bobby, I don't think we actually got your origin story out of you. Did you always know? Like, were you clear-headed? This is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Tell them your Tevye story.
Oh, well, that comes later, I think. Because started writing, I was, my parents were both, I don't know, I think they were sort of frustrated artists themselves. My dad was a writer, and I guess I felt like there was some element of him that wished that he had had that job, and that they always really wanted me to have that opportunity. And
when you say, what type of writer was he?
He wrote journalism and short stories and stuff like that.
And what specific job did he wish maybe that he might've had, like as a musician?
I don't think he wanted to write stories, but he ended up in PR and stuff like that, marketing.
Yeah.
But so there was nobody musical in my family, but for some reason, my mother was really excited that I might be musical. She wanted me to be.
Mm. And she willed it into you.
Willed it into me.
Thanks, and, Mom.
So there was one story where I told them that I wanted a guitar, and they were like, they were excited to hear that. I was 4 years old, and they said, we're going to get you a good guitar. And I was like, no, I just want the plastic one, the Mickey Mouse guitar from the drugstore.
Bobby was a little needy with his toys. He loves toys.
I just want a toy guitar.
You do love toys.
He loves toys.
True.
There are, many of his toys are not here anymore because we had to clear them out, and they're in a sort of a special toy room.
A toy vault.
A farm.
like it.
We've
like
sent them it. To the toy farm.
Exactly. Yeah, they're going to play with the others. So then we moved. Our family moved to Massachusetts and then moved very suddenly back to New York City because Massachusetts didn't work out. And we moved into a sublet, which had an upright piano.
Wow.
And so they said you should really take piano lessons, and I was really excited to see this thing. And that's when it started. And I had this amazing teacher who for a 6 year old started assigning me like right away every week to go home and write 4 bars of a piece.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've never heard of
it. Yeah, it was that's crazy. It was a huge gift. I mean, just I remember thinking like that, you're fucking with us. Like that's not something that I can't, like, I mean, write it on
you
the
can't
page.
Do it. But then you did.
Yeah. And yeah. So
where
he was the one.
Did you go to school? Did you go to piano lessons in the Village?
Yes.
Where?
The Greenwich House Music School.
So I used to live down there, and every time I would walk down the street, you would hear piano music floating out of the windows. It was always delightful, and it always made me think of you because yeah. I think I had heard that you went there, and so every time I pass by there and there's music floating out, I always think of you.
Aww.
I have another question, sort of a follow-up, even though you probably haven't told us your entire story, your entire origin story, but did you... Sometimes I just think it's easy to from the outside, look at someone who had certainty at an early age, followed by success, and just wonder, like, did you have any doubt in there? Were there nights, dark nights of the soul where you questioned?
You're just like, I don't want to fucking do piano lessons.
Yes,
did you have those? I want to hear about those.
Yeah.
How does that live for
you?
Well,
I had you know, in my early adolescence, really come to the realization I wanted to write musicals because I got into Sondheim and I was able to write all you know, I was in a drama group that had an original show every semester
and I
wrote them. So
and so
by the time I was in college, I was pretty burned out already because I had been writing all these musicals.
Just a cigarette dangling.
Yeah. He did wear a lot of black turtlenecks.
When you start.
It was he was very alienated. Like all these pictures sort of showed him just being like, I'm done.
I didn't actually smoke. I mean,
an imaginary cigarette.
Can't see everybody's gesture, but anyway.
But you were kind of burnt out in college.
I felt that way because, you know, when you start out and you're this kid with an aptitude, it's very cute and it's really impressive and you get a lot out of it.
Yeah.
And then as you get older and older.
Not so cute.
It gets less cute. It gets less impressive, especially if you have no money in sight. You
right.
know, I really didn't have any kind of plan or any shows that anybody wanted to do.
Interesting.
So for me, it was a lot of doubt. And there was a moment I joined the BMI workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan Menken came and did a master class. And I did a couple of songs from this project that I was doing. And he just, I don't know, the mood wasn't right. It didn't spark. And he kind of laid into them the way you do when you're a master class guy, you know, and you have to be the master up there. You gotta entertain the crowd.
Yeah. Nobody brings a master in to just be like,
amazing.
Wow! Oh my God.
But that is what
you were
hoping for.
That's what everyone's hoping for. And that's what nobody gets out of a master class.
Yeah.
Anyway. So that was my moment of like, should I, I can't do this. I'm not good. I threw that project away. And that's when I started collaborating. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, it is kind of like a story of giving up, but I think that is the key lesson is like when you are stuck, give up, let yourself off the hook and then let your creativity come out.
Yes.
It's interesting.
I mean, I feel like that's what really the essence of what we've been talking about from the start of this conversation.
Don't bang your head on the
Don't bang your head against wall.
Don't. If we're going to talk about like taking a dump in the pool, don't push too hard. Just let it That's come right. out naturally.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark file. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.
That was part one of our interview with Bobby Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez. Part two will be available next week, unless it's the future. Then it's available now. So go on, give it a listen, and find out what's sparking Bobby and Kristen these days.